Kenosha, 25 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night at Carthage College, it is the first of four performances this weekend of a relatively new play called Wherever You've Been. It is a play by a Carthage graduate by the name of Caitlin DiGiacomo. And I am so excited to be able to speak not only with the playwright, Caitlin DiGiacomo, but also with Adriana Jones, who is directing this production. It is a play that touches on the important theme of homelessness and springs at least in part by some of the playwright's encounters while growing up in Waukegan, Illinois. And the play touches on what we think of the homeless, the way in which we approach them, how we think of them so often as other in some ways that are really quite troubling. And I'm very excited to be able to explore some of these themes a little bit further. Adriana Jones is an adjunct assistant professor of theater at Carthage College and has already left her mark with some very, very good work. And you may remember her name from some of the work she has done in community theater here in southeastern Wisconsin. And she tells me she's about to direct a play at Case High School. Caitlin DiGiacomo is a writer and editor who deals mostly in fiction, actually has not done so much in the way of writing full-length plays, maybe just several of them, including this play that's going to be performed this weekend. Adriana Jones, Caitlin DiGiacomo, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you.
Thank you for making time for this and what I'm sure is a really, really busy week. Mm-hmm. In fact, Adriana, maybe you could just give us kind of a sense of where things are. We are actually recording this interview on Monday morning, and what stretches ahead of you and the cast over the next few days?
Well, we are in the thick of tech rehearsals. We started tech rehearsal last week, and yesterday evening we had two performances where we ran the show with all of the tech elements, and then in the evening we ran the show again for the first time in costume. So tonight we'll be putting it all together and adding hair and makeup, so a full-on dress rehearsal, and dress rehearsals begin this evening to prepare us for our opening night on Thursday.
All right.
Yep.
Exciting for all involved, I'm sure. Adriana, did you have anything to do with the selection of this play to be part of this season at Carthage?
I did. In conjunction with Herschel Kruger, who's our department chair of theater at Carthage, we were talking about plays around this time last year that I might direct at this time, and I was presented this play by Caitlin, among others we were looking at, and both of us, after reading it, it was, Herschel will agree, and he said to me that, oh, I started reading it and I couldn't put it down. And it is one of those plays where you kind of get sucked in and pulled into this world of these people and their stories. It goes by quickly, but also it's a nice length in terms of it fully explores these characters and you get to spend a good chunk of time with them.
Very good. So how exciting for you to be taking this on with a cast of how many?
Five actors.
Very good. So a relatively intimate play.
Yes.
That's the way I like them, actually. So Caitlin DiGiacomo, before we talk about this play, let's find out a little bit more about you, your own
sure.
background. You mentioned before we went on the air that you're actually a graduate of Carthage, and I know
yes.
from reading an article about this play that you are originally from, and I think now make your home in Waukegan,
correct,
Illinois.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about maybe your early life and at what point theater and writing started to become a really important part of your life.
Yeah, sure. Well, I actually am what they call a Carthage legacy, which basically is a fancy way of saying that I'm one in a long line of women who attended Carthage College, my mother and my sister both. And my sister is also a writer, and my mother too. And so it's really always storytelling has been a really rich part of my upbringing from infancy. So choosing Carthage was sort of this next step in this sort of history of women in my family going to Carthage. And I knew right away that I wanted to keep writing and that I wanted to learn more about theater and about creative writing. And so really started to kind of explore different genres and formats and the, you know, plays and poetry and fiction, short form, long form. And since graduating, I've really just kept working in the theater. I have done some teaching. I've done performing and playwriting, usually, like you mentioned, in a short form, but did do some long form, some full length plays. And I am currently a creative writing student at Emerson College in my master's studies. So just, yeah, trying to keep working on the page and off the page. And
so what did you major in at Carthage?
I was a theater major and a creative writing minor.
And were your theatrical exploits pretty much limited to off the stage, or were you on stage as a performer also?
I was a performance major for several years, and then I was a directing major for a little while, and I ended up choosing just sort of a general umbrella term of theater arts as my major. But yeah, I was on and off the stage both pretty equally. Yeah.
Very good. What were your earliest experiences with theater? I mean, what prompted the interest in the first place?
Wow, that's a good question. I think probably my first experience with performing was I was in choir in junior high school and in elementary school, and there's really a performative nature to music in a lot of ways. So I think that was probably my first experience with storytelling in a more physical format than just putting words down. Yeah, so that led to really just a thirst for performance arts in general.
So the first things you created as a writer, were they theatrical in nature, or was your first serious writing more, you know, poetry and short stories and other things like that?
I think my first serious writing was on the word processor in the early 90s. It was a horror story about an evil zipper on a winter coat. I think that was my first.
I was probably
seven. So it's
been,
yeah.
So thinking outside the box right from the start.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So as someone who is fluid in terms of the genres in which you write, just explain kind of the difference and what it feels like to sit down to craft a play versus what it feels like to sit down and craft something very different from a play,
Wow.
even if it also tells a story.
Yeah, that's such a great question. So I think really the difference for me is that one, if I'm working on a novel, like I'm working on a novel right now, and I am very conscious of how it sounds on the page, of how it sounds in your head, of the language translating in a sort of internal process. But when you're working on a play, you always have to keep in the back of your mind that it's an external process. This is going to be, someone's going to be moving, and they're going to be breathing, and they're going to be being heard out loud and speaking out loud. So I think the idea of what is this going to sound like spoken, what is this going to sound like given voice, is a consideration that I really have to take in when I'm working on a play, as opposed to working on a piece of fiction. So, including the body in this sort of exploration.
Right. Yeah. So this play that we're talking about today, Wherever You've Been, had its first performance back in 2017. Mm-hmm. How much playwriting had you done ahead of that? I mean, particularly in terms of full-length plays intended for the stage.
I really made my home in short form at Carthage and after I graduated, working in pretty much 10-minute plays. It was my favorite kind of area. And so I had done some 10-minute plays, and I had produced a collection of 10-minute plays that ended up being the amount of a full length, right? So several 10-minute plays to equal sort of 90 minutes. And I always had sort of a difficulty writing full-length plays. It felt like more of a challenge to me. So instead, when I approached this full-length show, I thought, why don't I try to write it in these like sort of littler chunks, right? Take this thing that I really enjoy, that I feel like I'm strong working with that form. And so I did sort of these monologues and then these short scenes, and then thought, oh yeah, this is gonna, I can put a through line in this. I can get this together into something full length. So, yeah.
So did something in particular prompt the writing of this play?
Yeah, I would say really two things. I grew up in Waukegan, but I ended up relocating back, coming back home again. And, It's a community that, like, pretty very similar to Kenosha. It's right on this centralized railway, and those types of places tend to be have a higher population of unhoused individuals, just for, you know, ease of travel and with those train stations right along those lines. So coming back to Waukegan really exposed me to a location and a community that has this really high population of homeless individuals. And so that, first of all, being sort of exposed and entrenched in that community in that way as an adult kind of opened my eyes to some of the issues going on. And I was also really interested in, any true crime fans will know, there was a case of a local woman that had gone missing that really, I couldn't let it go. I couldn't forget about it. I sort of an armchair detective, I guess. I thought, you know, I want to ask more questions. I want to find out some more about this. And what happens when a member of the homeless community who maybe doesn't have a support system or someone to advocate for them, what happens when they go missing? So I started trying to kind of find answers to these questions.
Right. Were you writing this play for something or someone in particular, or as just sort of for your own artistic purposes,
yeah,
and then with hopes that someday it would see life on the stage?
Yeah, I was really writing it for myself, I think. I was really writing it as a way to process a lot of these, like I said, these big questions that I had that didn't have answers, that maybe don't have answers, and sort of trying to use writing as a way to process my own feelings and my own exploration on the subject.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with playwright Caitlin DiGiacomo, whose play Wherever You've Been is going to be opening tomorrow night at Carthage College. And with us as well is Adriana Jones, who is the director of this production. She is an adjunct assistant professor of theater at Carthage. Caitlin, the article in the Chicago Tribune about the first performance of Wherever You've Been, I didn't get to read the entire article, but I gleaned from what I could see that it began with some comments from you about essentially what you used to think when you would see homeless people.
Absolutely.
Kind of hanging around the train depot or wherever you might encounter them. Tell us more about that. I mean, about kind of, as I suspect, as a relatively young person, maybe some of the assumptions you made or observations you
Definitely.
Made, and then how you maybe look at people who are homeless now.
Sure. Well, you know, it's one of those kind of uncomfortable subjects, right? It's something that we necessarily don't always look directly at, and I think that's a big theme in the show too, is that how many of us, you know, pass somebody on the street or pass a group of homeless individuals and sort of avert our eyes, right? We kind of look away, and that might not necessarily be a personal thing. It might just be because it makes us uncomfortable. It makes us feel too much. It makes us, you know, kind of overwhelmed. And I realized that I have really been doing that my whole life. I am standing in this place of privilege where I have a support system and I have a safe place to go, and really thinking about how we do take that for granted. I think we do have so much, even on our worst days, that someone else would be really grateful to have. So I think writing this play was really a way for me to examine my own bias and my own inaction when it comes to the homeless epidemic in this country specifically.
So. Right. So tell us about kind of the central story. You've already touched on the matter of kind of a true crime story, in this case, a homeless woman going missing.
Correct.
But tell us about the other characters who, in a sense, surround her.
So it is a story about this young woman who goes missing, and the sort of narrative takes the shape of kind of interviews with some of the other members of the homeless shelter where she had been staying. So what might be considered her community, her closest friends or her associates or the people who knew her best are sort of being interviewed. And through those interviews, you get this sort of broader glance at who they are as their own people. So there are a couple different characters who sort of shape our view of who the missing woman is. We sort of learn about her through their lens, and they have their own stories to tell too. So we get to learn a little bit about some of the other individuals and their own unique experiences based on their own either background or history or social standing. And yeah, we get to learn about a couple different folks in the show. Mm.
I'm going to be careful not to draw out too much information. I mean, I suspect there are certain things you want left for people to discover by attending the play itself. But can I ask, when the curtain goes up or the lights come up or whatever, do we actually meet this woman who... Or is she already missing as the play begins?
Yes, to both. She is, Mandy is the name of the woman who is missing. And she's really sort of the main character of the show, even though she is missing from before the curtain opens and after the curtain closes. She's really present. Adriana has staged this in such a beautiful way that Mandy is... We're following her through every scene, even when she isn't present. We're seeing her kind of live this whole life, even though she is not necessarily speaking any lines at the time. So, yeah, I think really very crucial character in the show. Yeah. Wow.
Adriana, tell us more about, well, first of all, tell us about, from your perspective, how this play is put together, the way in which Caitlin has constructed it, and maybe what sorts of rich opportunities it affords you and the actors with which you're working.
Mm-hmm. Well, with this play, as Caitlin was saying, that it has these monologues as if these characters are being interviewed, kind of interspersed throughout the show. And correct me if I'm wrong, did it originally start like as a verbatim play?
Yeah, it started as really a collection of these verbatim monologues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So verbatim meaning is usually, if it's a verbatim play, these are words that were the words of real people mm-hmm. who were interviewed. And so part of that, that's kind of where we started. And it's a big part of this show in terms of what we explored with the cast and the actors is these were real people. So can you, I encourage the actors to find inspiration in a real person who, and use them as either a guide regarding their gestures or their experiences and looking into their backgrounds to help inform their performances and find the reality and the humanity of these people who really did exist. Because it's one thing to create a character from nothing, but it's another thing to really try and bring to life a person who already exists, you know, and really portray their story honestly and organically. Yeah.
Tell us more about these interviews, which serve as at least some of the source material for the play. When and by whom were these interviews conducted?
Yeah, so these interviews were all conducted by me over the course of many, many months. And I basically, you know, sort of followed this thread, right? If I heard, oh, so-and-so is really usually at this place at this time, I might try to follow that thread to that next. And they might mention, oh, you know, so-and-so is really... knowledgeable on this particular subject, so I'd follow the thread over to that person and held a lot of different interviews at different locations in person. This was pre-pandemic, so there was a lot of opportunity for gathering together in sort of these spaces. And yeah, they really started out as being mostly strangers, some people that I might have known at just sort of cursory acquaintances, but they a lot of them really became people that I came to really care about, people that I came to feel very strongly for. So it really sort of feels like just amplifying voices of these people that I love and respect. Yeah.
Mm. Under what circumstances did these interviews take place? That's actually not what I'm really asking. What I'm asking is, what did you tell them in terms of why you were in terms of why you were talking to them? And maybe that doesn't even matter. And maybe it was different from person to person. But I mean, with at least some of them, were they told why you were interested in talking to them?
Yes. I think I tried to be very upfront. And I also, you know, whenever I'm writing a story, I try to be really conscious of what story I'm choosing to write, because I think, you know, we've heard a lot from middle-aged white ladies at this point. So I try to really amplify some voices that might not have an opportunity to be amplified otherwise. And so I sort of phrased it like that. I sort of said, you know, I really want to get your perspective. I really want to get the perspective of real humans that exist in these circumstances that make their lives in this community, and give them a chance to tell their own story, not have someone else tell their story for them.
Right.
So, yeah.
I don't remember if you've said this, but how many people are we talking about that you interviewed?
Yeah, it was probably, I think the end result was about a dozen folks. And some of those, I had, you know, two police officers who I talked to really, really extensively that sort of came together into one character, right? Mm. Or I had, you know, these three young women who maybe came together as this, represented by this one young woman in the scene. So, yeah, really closely conversing with probably, yeah, a dozen folks by the end of the process.
Wow. Adriana, maybe you could summarize for us these. So it's four characters besides the missing woman?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe summarize for us who they are.
Sure. Well, one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that the other four actors, besides the actor who plays Mandy, actually play multiple people.
Oh.
So, yes. So
so it's a cast of five, but many more characters than five.
Yes. Okay. And the other four actors, each of them at least play two people. So, and honestly, I whenever we've worked on them, I refer to one of them as like the alter ego of the other, because what Caitlin did so brilliantly is that how she paired the characters together. One actor is exploring essentially the antithesis of each person. So they might be playing the police officer, but then the opposite of that police officer is this veteran. And so it's maybe not the opposite, but a person who, if they had maybe taken a different route in their journey of life, they could have ended up as this person. Yeah. And so each actor has that that yin and yang that they're presenting in their characters, which provides a lovely acting challenge for them, which is why we started with physicality and how do these people move through space as a way to inform them, so that we could see them on stage and visually know, oh, they are this person now, or, oh, they are this person now, even before we started adding costumes and things. So regarding each of those, like one group of four characters who might be in part of that unhoused group of people, and then the other group who are on the other side of things, there's also scenes interspersed where that group of friends or associates of unhoused folks engage with one another. And then on the opposite side, the group of community members who are addressing this issue of unhoused people in the community are getting together in scenes. Mm. So you get to see both sides of this story, both sides of this issue, if you will, and explore like, okay, wow, it asks some questions, right, of the audience, like, okay, not necessarily who's right or who's wrong, but can we understand how this group of people can believe this way and this other group has this stance on this issue, right, and see both sides, right?
Wow. That I should think enriches the play tremendously. That it,
yes, definitely.
That comes at it from that way. Caitlin, one sad reality is that of course, we tend to, of course, about all kinds of things, paint with a broad brush of mm-hmm. generalization, and that's such a mistake. And it's certainly a mistake and a disservice to people experiencing homelessness to paint with a broad brush. Mm-hmm. That being said, it's certainly, without a doubt, one issue that often is a part of these people's lives is often that there is the specter of mental illness for some reason, or perhaps addiction or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, how much of those sort of specters did you encounter in the dozen or so people that you interviewed? And also, how much is that really unfortunate reality woven into the fabric of your play and into these characters?
Oh, yeah, enormously. So I think really the characters, other than being very specific individuals in and of themselves, they also represent sort of this community within a community in this unhoused population. So we have a character who is a veteran, which is an enormous percentage of the population of unhoused individuals in this country. So that character does really deal with, you know, struggles with these mental issues and isn't able to find or access the support that maybe someone else in a different circumstance might be able to. And there is a character struggling with addiction, and there is a character who is addressing this percentage of trans and queer individuals within the unhoused population. So I think there are a lot of different issues that you get to see sort of this slice of life, this window into that specific area within the community of itself. So, yeah.
Wow. Adriana, what has it been like for the students with whom you've been working in this cast? I mean, by and large, how many of them have had sort of serious encounter with this population or given much thought to this? I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just curious how much mm-hmm. of this is a very much a new exploration.
Mm-hmm. Good question. I mean, I would have to dig deeper in terms of asking folks like in our cast, how much experience they've had and personally with folks who are unhoused. But I know that it's something that, at least one among the cast has been able to share, oh, yes, a personal story of they've either, as Caitlin was mentioning earlier, whether it's been an up-close and personal interaction with someone who's unhoused. I think we've all had that, and we've connected with that when we were talking about the show in the beginning of the process, that we maybe see someone on the street with a begging sign or asking for change. That's a frequent sight, especially in urban communities such as like these metropolitan areas that we have quite close, Milwaukee and Chicago. Like it's on every street corner almost. You can't walk a couple blocks without seeing that kind of scene. And so I think we all, and even the students and actors, have in some way seen this. And so it was an interesting experience for them to get to know these people. And one thing, and we didn't, I don't know if you read my director's note, because you literally, when you were talking about seeing these folks, it's like we see them on the side of the street and we might avert our gaze or maybe walk to the other side of the street. That's something that I talked a lot about with the actors in terms of what does it mean to truly see someone?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and not just see them on the street and choose to look away, but to see them and actually see them as a person, mm-hmm. as a human being, and not brush them aside,
right?
And so I hope it was an enjoyable experience for the actors to be able to have the opportunity to explore the lives of people mm-hmm. who often don't get a chance to be seen and has given them a new perspective on what they might do if presented with that experience again, like on the street or in their future life experience.
what has it been like to do a play in which the playwright is not only alive and well, but alive and well and living right down the road from Carthage? I assume you've taken bountiful advantage of that.
Yes, we've had Caitlin in the rehearsal room with us several times, and it's been great to have her throughout the process. She's been so gracious, and honestly, it has helped us find a version of the show that fits and suits like our actors specifically too, which is awesome and doesn't always happen. So there are moments that we are. Have catered to the actors that are performing them in terms of their look, their sense of self, to help inform those characters and make them feel closer to them in terms of how they can perform them. And so having Caitlin be a part of the process has been really awesome. I mean, like, I've tried not to bug her too much, being like,
stick with me.
Yeah, Caitlin, what about this? What about this? She's like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. Oh, yeah, totally, do it. I'm like, okay.
Fantastic. And Caitlin, I should think it must be a delight, maybe a thrill, to see this play taking shape on the stage like this.
Absolutely, yeah. It's been just... start to finish, just such an incredible experience. They have done such amazing work on this project, and I could not be prouder of it. Yeah.
Is this the first time it has actually been done in fully staged format? You were telling me the world premiere I was reading about was actually more of a staged reading.
Yeah, it was. We didn't really have sort of this traditional idea of lights and sound and crew and costumes. So this is the first time it's really been a fully formed theatrical production, and it's it's really amazing.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope many people are going to seek out the opportunity to see Wherever You've Been by Caitlin D. Giacomo. It is performed tomorrow night, Thursday night, 7:30, also Friday and Saturday night, 7:30, and then Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. This is in Wartburg Auditorium?
This is in our studio theater.
Oh, studio theater in the basement, of the Straj Building. Mm-hmm. And if people want to secure their tickets, what do they do?
They can go online to the box office website Carthage website. They can also get them in person if they are on campus at the box office. The theater box office is open noon to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday on Carthage campus, and that's located in the Straz building in the lobby.
Very good. Adriana Jones is the director of Wherever You've Been, this production of this play by Caitlin D. Giacomo. It was wonderful to speak with both of you, and best wishes to you, cast and crew, on what we hope will be well-attended and well-received performances of what sounds like a very... And for part two of today's morning show, first of all, we are departing from what was our published schedule because of the illness of what was supposed to be my second guest today, Jenny Hoffman, the director of the musical Avenue Q, which is about to open at the Rhodey Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha, presented by the Lakeside Players. So those performances are going to be for the next 3 weekends, and Jenny just hoped I could announce a little bit about the show. In a tongue-in-cheek spoof and homage to Sesame Street, Avenue Q features a lively, infectious score and a beautifully written script tackling some socially relevant themes, including racism, homophobia, homelessness, commitment, and ultimately obtaining one's purpose in life. And it is a musical done with puppets. And a live pit band will be accompanying this cast. You can get more information at rhodeycenter.org. And we hope Jenny Hoffman is feeling better soon. So for a different part two, and one that I'm very excited about, we're going to actually spend the final minutes of today's morning show talking about a great anniversary that kicks off this coming Sunday. It is the 185th anniversary of First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine. I happen to belong to a church that's been around a while. We just celebrated our 125th, and we're very proud of being around that long. And here, 60 years before that, the congregation that is First Presbyterian Church was founded. And I'm very excited to be able to spend these next few minutes with Reverend Darren Utley, who is the pastor at First Presbyterian. We're going to talk a little bit about this church's really impressive and inspiring history, and we'll touch a little bit on some of the ways in which this milestone is going to be celebrated. Reverend Darren Utley, we welcome you to the morning show.
All right. Well, thank you, Greg. It's really a pleasure to be here. I know that a lot of my congregation listen, and so I know they're out there right now. So thank you so much for having us on. Yeah,
very good to have you here. Remind me how long you've been at First Presbyterian. I know it hasn't been terribly long.
Okay. Well, I came to First Presbyterian on July 4th of 2021 was my first Sunday. I have to say, Sunday mornings and on July 4th in Racine is not always the best time to get a good crowd. they're preoccupied with That's the parade, right. But yeah. it was only uphill from there.
Ah, very good. Well, it's an exciting place to be, and of course, many people are aware of all of the things that go on there related to various social justice issues, and certainly music plays a huge part, music and the arts, with the Music and More series and so on. So one does not have to be Presbyterian to have great interest in this particular congregation and all the things that go on in that beautiful facility. I suspect that you have done a little catching up over the short time you've been there to the incredible and long history of this congregation. And, of course, that makes an anniversary like this all the more exciting and meaningful. Why don't you sketch for our listeners what you think is most important for them to know about this congregation's long history over 185 years?
Well, yeah, thank you, Greg. That's a good question. One of the things that really impressed me as I was, you know, trying to discern where I was being called by God to serve was this long history of First Presbyterian Church in Racine. It began in 1839, which people could figure out the dates if they wanted to do the math, but I'll just lay it out there for them. It was about 22 or 23 people gathered together to decide if they wanted to have a Congregational or a Presbyterian church. They decided on Presbyterian for a time, at least. And then some of the Congregationalists started their own place. But really the thing that is probably most impressive about those early days was, Wisconsin itself and the people of Racine had a very strong abolitionist bent, in those early years. That part of the history and the way that that was a key part of the church, especially after the building where it sits now was built in 1852, really was impressive to me. They took many stands on issues. They were part of the people who helped the Republican Party that ended up bringing Abraham Lincoln forward to come forward, were people out of this church. The story of Joshua Glover that takes place in Racine, an escaped enslaved person who, after the Fugitive Slave Act, his former enslaver comes up to capture him again, and he's captured and taken to Milwaukee. And the story is that many people in Racine, they rang the bell at First Presbyterian Church. They gathered in the town square and went up to Milwaukee and joined a group there and busted him out of the jail there and helped him get up to Canada. So, all of that history, when I was when I was coming to the church, part of the committee, you know, they said, we know this history and we are wondering how we can revive and relive, you know, some of that abolitionist history, what it means for us today. And that really aligned with a lot of the work that I had been doing in Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy.
So there was this kind of old American
history kind of joined for me
yeah.
in these two locations.
Right, there you are.
Yeah.
Capital of the Confederacy to a church that was part of the Underground Railroad. That really says a lot.
Yeah.
As I was reading a little bit about your congregation's history on your really beautifully laid out website, yeah. one of the things that jumped out at me was, as you said, it was founded in 1839, if I read correctly, yeah. 2 years prior to Racine being incorporated as a village.
Right.
So, I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about what it means to be starting a congregation in a place like that that
yeah.
doesn't even have a courthouse yet
right.
and doesn't have, you know, kind of any of that sort of official infrastructure of being a village, let alone a city.
Exactly.
Kind of fun to think back about that. And, of course, your sanctuary, I mean, your entire facility,
yeah.
but your sanctuary in particular, of course, is exceptionally beautiful, and that has to be a joy to be at a place that has such a lovely space.
Yeah, it was one of the things, it's another one of the things that attracted me to the space, that you could really, the acoustics and the sound in there is just incredible. If you have a soloist singing from the chancel, or if you have a whole symphony in there,
yeah.
they both sound incredible.
Mm-hmm.
It is beautifully designed. One of the history buffs in the congregation would be angry with me if I didn't mention that when they finished the church in 1852 and they opened the doors and let the pastor at the time in, the rumor is that he danced down the aisles in excitement for the completion and what he saw there. They have been trying to get me to recreate that moment, but I said, this is the 185th anniversary of the church, of the congregation, not the building, so maybe...
Right.
You know?
There you go. Yes. And,
if I'm here, then.
Yeah, in 20 or 30 yeah. years, maybe you'll dance.
And if I can pick up where you left off there as well, you know, one of the things that, again, with that building now being recognized by the National Park Service as a stop on the Underground Railroad, that the beauty of the sanctuary is now has a kind of, moral beauty to know that people were hiding people there to get them on ships, to get them to Canada and to help them along their way. And I know for me personally, I really can feel that when I sit and take time in that space. So,
right. I love when you sit in that gorgeous, open, radiant space, and then you think about that secret tunnel also part of First Presbyterian Church,
right.
and you think about how, in a sense, holy those two spaces
right.
are, even though to look at them, they could not be more different.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
right.
a wonderful story. I love the something else on your website, which said that this beautiful church building, when it was built, cost $10,600, which I suppose was a princely sum back in 1852.
Right.
One sort of shudders to think what you can build with $10,000 nowadays. So it's such a great history, and there's so many things to be proud of and to celebrate, which of course brings us to this 185th anniversary. So I imagine you and some committee sat down to think about how this could be celebrated, and I know there's going to be a number of celebrations, but the kind of the big kickoff is this Sunday. I know your own Sunday morning worship is going to be a celebratory.
Yeah.
But then what happens after that Sunday morning?
Yeah, so we will celebrate in the service. It is the first Sunday in Lent, so we have to, you know, pay homage to the Lenten season as well. But
no party hats there.
Yeah,
yes,
you know,
right.
but we will... One thing I'll mention just about the worship service beforehand is that one of the special things that will happen during that service is that our choir director and organist, accompanist, has written a special piece of music for organ and bell choir. I think Alejandro has been there maybe 12, 15 years. I can't remember the dates exactly, but you know, he said he just really wanted, he's been wanting to do something for the church for a while. And so he composed this piece. It should be, I've heard it one time, kind of in a simulation, not in the, not actually played. And it's kind of cool because it plays on the first, the eighth, and the fifth for the 185. So he kind of does this musical theme. So that'll happen in, at the postlude part of the service. So just thought I should mention that for sure. And then after that, we'll have a little time of festivities in the sanctuary. We will honor, we have at least, I think it's 30 plus folks who have been members for over 50 years.
Wow.
So we'll have, you know, kind of list them out and recognize them. The current moderator of the presbytery will be there to kind of, you know, give us recognize this this accomplishment. And then the mayor, Corey Mason, will be there to read a proclamation from the city. And I think that's the main thing that happens in the in that festivity part. We will then go to the fellowship hall, and we've got a lovely cake. I think we're actually following in your all's lead by we have a new logo that was designed for our 185th, and so we'll have a cake with our new logo on it. So we know we learned that from good folks how to celebrate,
right.
And so we'll have a little more time of celebration there with you know, just sharing of food and fun together in there. So
fantastic!
It should be a great great time.
And of course, this is just the kickoff of what I imagine will be a number of events that will be coming in the months and ahead. And I would suggest that people look to the website of First Presbyterian Church. And there's a place where it's something about us.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see who the staff is and different sorts of things. But then there's something you click on called Our History, and it includes some really nice information beyond what you've just shared, and some photographs and so on that kind of take us a bit back through the history, and it's a wonderful thing to be around 185 years and in this day and age in particular. So we hope people will make note of that, and at various points in time be part of the festivities. So. And we appreciate you joining us, Reverend Darren Utley, who is the pastor at First Presbyterian Church. So happy anniversary to you and yours, and may it be a grand celebration indeed.
All right. Thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear for his first visit to the program in 2024, offering his thoughts and commentary on a number of different issues. And then on Friday, you'll hear the interview that I recorded with the author of a brand new book called The Tiger Bells. The Tiger Bells were some brilliant track athletes, women track athletes, from Tennessee State University, and they took the 1960 Rome Olympic Games by storm. Led by Wilma Rudolph, they dominated the proceedings in women's track and field. It's a spectacular story, and a story that begins in the most humble of circumstances. And it's a fascinating story told very thoroughly in this book, again, called The Tiger Bells. And you'll hear my interview with the author on Friday's morning show. And we want to remind you as well that Nan Calvert has stepped down as a regular contributor to The Morning Show. But in the weekend podcasts of The Morning Show over all this month, we're going to be sharing some of our favorite Nan Calvert interviews from the past. So please make a note of that. The Morning Show podcast can be found under the title The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today's going to be sunny and mild with a high of 46 degrees, but clouds are going to roll in tonight, and we expect a rain-snow mix after midnight and possibly an inch of accumulation, overnight low of 35. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be cloudy as well with a rain-snow mix in the morning, but sunshine by the afternoon with a high of 37 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.